Good evening, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 24th in the year 2000. This afternoon in our fireside room, we are pleased to have as our presenter, Cynthia Mo-Lobita. She is continuing her series on economic globalization and the promise of God dwelling within us. Today's presentation is called Communion Across the Ages, Seeking Moral Wisdom and Faith for Bearers. Let's listen in.
Well, I think we will begin on time. It's wonderful to see so many familiar faces back. I'm Cynthia Mo-Lobita, and this is the session on economic globalization and the promise of God living in us as a source of moral spiritual power. Before we begin, it would be useful to me to have a hand show of the people that have been here for both of the two previous sessions. If I could see, or let me see the hands that have not been here for both of the previous two. Okay. Then I will take a few minutes, a very brief time, to situate this session in the context of the series of five sessions on this topic. Before I do that, let me take just a moment to share with you a couple of books that are in the bookstore that were ordered for the purpose of supplementary reading to these sessions. One is Biopiracy by Vandana Shiva, an Indian physicist who's working on issues of biodiversity and cultural diversity and the impact of globalization on those two issues. The other is Larry Rasmussen's Earth Community, Earth Ethics, which is an excellent book. It won the best book of the world in the world in religion, the Grandmeyer a Religion Award in 1997, and it does a good work of situating globalization in the context of Christian faith and looking at the hope of earth-based Christian faiths to lead us out of some of this quagmire. And the other is The Great Work by Thomas Berry. So these are all in the bookstore, and take a look at them, and I do highly recommend all three of them. Welcome. Just come on in and take a seat. Just for the purpose now of putting this session in the context of the other five that we're doing, the intent of these five hours together is to face a fundamental life-shaping contradiction within which we all live. It's a contradiction that, to me, is haunting, deeply, deeply haunting. And the contradiction is this. As people of Jesus Christ, as followers of Jesus Christ, we are called to love neighbor as self. This morning in the Galatians Bible study, in Galatians 5 something, I think we read again the great, all of the law summed up in this: love thy neighbor as thyself. And it's throughout Jesus' teachings. It is our call, it is our invitation, it is also our promise, it is our freedom. It is that for which we were born, to receive God's love, to love God in return, and to love others, and to love self. That is implicit in love neighbor as self. So here we are, and I would wager a bet that every person sitting in this room longs to live according to neighbor love. In our hearts, that is part of our longing. And yet, in stark and tragic contrast, we live every day of our lives in profound complicity with global economic arrangements that spell death for many, many people, and that are quite literally destroying Earth's life support systems. Tonight there's a movie on global warming, and I have not seen it, but I warrant it will give details on some of the dangers imposed by life as we know it that is being promoted throughout the world through economic globalization. So here we are, none of us wanting to brutalize other people, yet all of us eating probably fresh strawberries that are grown on land that should be growing corn and beans and rice for Mexican children. We are wearing, our kids are playing with soccer balls that are stitched by Indonesian boys who lose their eyes at age 11 from the multiple hours of stitching balls. We live in ways that are, I spent 2 years as a missionary in Honduras, bananas, multinational banana companies, and banana workers will lose their feet standing in chemicals. And yet we eat those bananas at extraordinarily cheap rates. Our food is the cheapest in the world. How is it that we agree to this? How is it that we go on living in these ways? This is the contradiction that I want us to hold up. And I would suggest to you that simply to face it, to take it seriously, is an act of profound courage. That anyone who says, I will look at this, is a person of courage and will walk through, and many of you have, rage and grief and hope and many emotions. So this is the contradiction that we look at. In our sessions together, we're asking just two questions, and there are many other questions to ask. The two that we're digging into are these, and they're listed here. One is this. If the prevailing model of globalization brutalizes the poor and jeopardizes Earth's regenerative capacities, why do we acquiesce to that model without standing up and declaring it an affront to our faith? Why don't we find other ways of living? The second question is, where in our Christian faith traditions are we offered hope and the moral spiritual power to resist, revision, and rebuild economic ways that nurture communities and the earth community, which will sustain life according to justice and compassion for generations to come? Where do we find that hope and moral spiritual power? These questions are situated in other important questions, and I think that's clear. In ethics, ethics has many tools. Ethics is a wonderful discipline of Christian theology, but I would suggest that these questions are part of a broader schema of questions. Descriptive questions. What is going on here? The first thing we need to ask is, what's happening? We need to demystify the global economy. We need to ask, secondly, normative questions. What ought to be going on? How should we define the purpose of economic life? Economics comes from the same Greek word as koinonia, the hall in which we're sitting. Community, fellowship. How do we define the purpose of economic life according to its root word in the Greek, in biblical language? Third, evaluative questions. How does what's going on measure up to what ought to be going on? Fourth, constructive questions. And stop there for a minute. By that I mean, what are the alternatives? It's clear that in these sessions we're not spending time looking at pragmatically what we could do differently. And we actually will be in some sessions next week. But the reason I'm not doing that is because I know that those questions are being addressed, and I know that you can get books. The alternatives are out there, are on the table, can be studied and read and lived into. But I often feel that the question that's not looked at is, where do we get the moral courage to live into those alternatives? And that's what we're dealing with in these days. So I situate the questions we're playing around with within this series of questions. Our questions being the last one, the fifth, transformative. What stops us and what empowers us to live differently? So in the first day, we looked at sort of what is going on in economic globalization. We looked at five defining trends. And in the second day, we looked at some reasons we acquiesce. Why do we acquiesce? Today, we're moving to some preliminary work for the question of, where do we find the moral power for resistance and living into alternatives? I personally fear, I fear the sense of powerlessness and the retreat into private morality that accompanies beginning to face the complexities of economic globalization. I fear it because I've experienced it. I know the deep desire to just ignore it and become a good person in every way that I can in my personal life, but just leave that away. So I fear that. I also fear the passivity, the moral passivity, the inertia that characterizes our society in the face of economic globalization. We who are largely educated and economically privileged tend somehow, even when we know what's wrong, even when we know there are alternatives, we somehow seem to go on with this trajectory of economic life. Somehow we are so malformed by living according to economic injustice that it takes more than knowledge to reform us. So we come to the second question, and I'll state it differently. Wherein lies the moral, spiritual power and hope in the face of seemingly impenetrable economic systems which structure exploitation into our lives? Where are we to find the moral, spiritual power and hope to live otherwise? That's what we sit with today. I will say that the voice of hope is strong, and the rays of hope are many. One of the rays of hope is the communities of people around the globe that are structuring alternatives, theoretically and practically, living in alternative ways. And many of us experience little bits and pieces of that. We're familiar probably with fair trade. We know we can buy our coffee in ways that the producers in the little hills, the big hills of Central America, for instance, get a fair compensation. We're familiar with bits of that, but there are profound alternatives out there, and that is a ray of hope. A second ray of hope is the great faith traditions of this earth. I would suggest that those of us who are situated in a faith tradition are bound to dig into it for sources of hope and moral spiritual power. In one of the sessions, the first session that Barbara Rossing was doing and talking about sources of resistance, analysis and power for resistance in Revelation, and someone else brought up sources of power and resistance in indigenous traditions. All people in faith traditions need to dig deep, and we dig deep into the Christian tradition. I don't use the word tradition lightly, and tradition is what we're here to talk about today. In the Greek, the word tradition was initially used in the New Testament Greek, the word is a verb before it's a noun. It is to tradition, it is to pass on. The good news was traditioned, it was passed on. We are called to receive the traditioning of our ancestors, the passing on, and to hear the good news that they passed on. When we as Christians turn to our faith forebearers, I think we are faced with a startling and kind of awe-inspiring contradiction. Whereas we tend toward passivity, somehow I think we tend to say, I can't do anything to confront massive injustice, we happen to be the descendants of a great cloud of witnesses that didn't have that conviction of passivity, who somehow, and certainly not all our faith forebearers, many of them were enormously complicit with injustice, and that we all know. But within the tradition, throughout all the centuries, were people who, in faith, lived up, stood up in resistance to structures of power seemingly as strong as economic globalization today. Has anyone seen the film Weapons of the Spirit about the Huguenot community in France that literally a small village that housed 4,000 Jews under the occupation of the Nazis? Where did they get that moral power? Throughout history, there are great resistors who are our grandparents. And it seems to me that one of our jobs is to turn to them. To turn to them and to say, how is it that you had this kind of power to follow Jesus? Early second century communities that I've spent a great deal of time with, Irenaeus of Lyon and his community, one of the most martyred communities in the history of the early church, who claimed Jesus as Lord when doing so meant not only being killed, but being killed brutally by lions and other forms of torture. Where did they get that moral power? I would suggest that for many of our ancestors, The spiritual moral power to follow Jesus came from a deep conviction and experience of relationship with God, part of which was God living in them. A beautiful, beautiful statement by Irenaeus, who I just mentioned, was that the dew of God's Spirit is diffused throughout all the earth. I think about the dew of God's Spirit diffused in all of us. We are watered by word and wisdom, the hands of God watering us and filling us. We are ever being shaped and molded. We are wet clay. We are moist clay in the hands of our Creator, being shaped and molded into union and communion with our Creator. Now imagine us being shaped into union and communion. Imagine us being filled literally with the God of love, the God of profound love. And clearly I am making a presupposition here about love, that love is not necessarily an emotion as much as it is a profound living out of, living into the well-being of that which is loved. Love being a very, very active verb, not only an emotional verb. So, frankly, to tell you a little of my story, I began to, in studying church history, began to find so many people and so many communities who were convicted that not only is God out there, not only is God transcendent, but God is immanent, very, very literally immanent within us. And I simply began to ask, how can it be that we don't know that? And I mean know in the deep sense of know, as of know it so that we live it. If Jesus loved so profoundly that nothing could stop his serving the well-being of the most marginalized, how is it that though that love lives in us, we don't know it? We don't experience it, embody it, and live it? So this is why I am convicted, bound to the notion that our ancestors can teach us something, and they can teach us something about being filled with God. Now, those of us who are Lutherans are unfamiliar probably with the fact that in Luther there is powerful language of God filling all of creation, us, human beings, as well as every creature and element out there, not only the creatures, but the leaves. Every single leaf is full of the power and presence of God. Human being, Christ comes to live. The reason we love neighbors in Luther is not just out of gratitude to God. It's because Jesus comes to live in us, and our neighbor love comes out of that. We are going to discuss more of that in the fifth session, and I won't go more into that now, but my point is, if we're Lutherans and if we have that in our heritage, how can we dig deeper and draw upon Luther and others who believed in that presence within us? So that's the thing I put forth here, that we have ancestors to draw upon. Now, it seems to me that there are profound barriers to seriously drawing upon the moral wisdom of our faith forebearers. And the barriers are so strong that we usually don't do it. What problems do you see? I mean, I'm not going to take a lot of time for discussion, but just throw out, what do you see as one of the reasons why you may not have turned to your ancestors in the faith for moral guidance about burning moral issues today? Why haven't you sought out their wisdom? Yes?
If you work in medicine and technology in our modern society, modern economy, there is a very strong ethic or belief, I don't happen to agree with it, but there's a very strong ethic that anything that is old is of no value. The newest stuff is of value and useful. So that stands in direct contradiction to going back into the ages of people 200, 300, 400, 500, maybe even longer than that, years ago, and the wisdom that they may have to apply to situations that together. Mm-hmm. They couldn't have imagined, at least in our context.
Okay, so there are a couple of things you've said. One is just the kind of the general opinion that old knowledge doesn't bear any weight today. And the other is a different point that you made, is that they didn't face what we're facing, so how can we seek wisdom from them? I think those are two very powerful reasons why we don't turn to our ancestors, our grandparents, for knowledge. Any other barriers that you see? Yes.
As a layperson without a theological education, I often assume that I won't understand the language in a book, and I can flipping through a book and it said hermeneutics, and I thought, well, there's quite a bit in this book.
Right. Right. Gee.
Oh, no,
yeah. Well, that you've said a lot there, too. You've made a lot of points, and those are good points. One of them is the failure of the academic community to speak in intelligible English. That's one of the problems.
So, don't you think it's kind of scary to look at the prospect of martyrdom?
That's another good point. It might be scary knowing that some of those who were the most faithful lost their lives for it. Yeah. As one of the Berrigan brothers said, if you want to follow Jesus Christ, you better look good on wood. And, you know, the follow me passages in the book of Mark are follow me directly to the cross. You know, the whole follow me is to Jerusalem. So that's a very good point. Yeah. Do we really want to claim these as our ancestors? I think the other point that was inherent in what you said, and correct me if I'm misreading you, is I just lost it.
Well, about not sure if I'll understand the language, and it's an assumption on my part too that I will not.
Yes. You know. I think part of what you're saying there, and do tell me if I'm wrong, is that we aren't raised knowing the stories of our faith forebearers. We may be raised in the biblical stories. Mm-hmm. But we aren't raised to understand ourselves as in the community of Irenaeus of Lyon, in the community of the medieval women's movement that literally defied the Roman Catholic Church, and many of whom were burned. We don't see them as our grandmothers, that kind of courage. Do we know well the stories of Dietrich Bonhoeffer in our own Lutheran tradition? Deeply embedded in Bonhoeffer's later works, our notion that we become the bodies of Christ, that we are formed into the form of Jesus Christ. He is one of the people for whom the indwelling God is very significant. Am I raising my boys to know that part of their identity is this? And if we were, then the language of some of the historical books would be more intelligible.
That's a sad gap.
It's a sad gap, mm-hmm. And it's a.
You find all kinds of kids' Bible stories, but you don't find any of the stuff about the early Christians in children's language or simple language, lay language.
And it may go back to part of what you said, Robin. It's scary stories. So those are some significant reasons.
But along the same line, I mean, it's also scary to not go with the flock, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh boy, that's a very good point. I remember taking, I used to lead delegations of people to Central America for fact-finding inquiries, and I had all kinds of people, and in one of my delegations I had a number of business people, including a very, very successful Wall Street lawyer, and a very sophisticated man, a man that, very interesting intellectually, and at one point he broke down sobbing, and he said, with what I know now, my friends, where will I be with my friends? So in other words, to go against the flock with his knowledge was to jeopardize his standing in his community. I would like to pull out a couple of barriers to deal with. One of them is one that was raised here, going in reverse order here, the second one that I think we'll deal with, and that is, how do we turn to people who never faced anything vaguely similar to the moral crises we face? I'd like to do that one second. I'd like to spend a little bit of time on another barrier that I see. And this one may be meaningful to all of you and may not. The way I say it is this: what's a good feminist doing turning to Martin Luther? And that's a code word to say, what's anyone of social consciousness doing, turning to a faith forebearer that said and did atrocious things? Can you name any aspects of Luther or the Lutheran tradition that would discredit Luther and the tradition as moral guides? Anything that comes to mind?
Statement against the Jews.
The Jews, okay.
Diatribe against the Jews.
Diatribe against the Jews, good.
The peasants.
The peasants, the profound stand against the peasant rebellion, even though Luther attributed the peasant rebellion to the oppressive landlords. He took a stand against the peasants, and that contributed to the theological rationale for killing them. Good. Those are two very important issues.
Support of the civil authorities to execute the Anabaptists.
Right. Okay. His stands against the Anabaptists. Lutheran tradition? Problems in Lutheran tradition?
The German church in the face of Nazism.
Okay, the German church in the face of Nazism. Mm-hmm.
Could you stand up in this country when apparently everyone knew what was happening to the Jews in the Holocaust?
Okay, failure to stand up sooner in relationship to the killing of Jews in the Holocaust. It seems to me these are reasons that render Luther, at least the ones pertaining to him, the Anabaptists, the peasants, the Jews, suspect. And I want to make that point strongly because I think it's a major issue. I'm going to read to you a few lines from his, I can't remember the year he wrote it, later, I think it was about in the late 20s, 1520s, on the Jews and their lies. This is Luther. I shall give you my sincere advice. First, to set fire to their synagogues and schools. Second, I advise that their houses also be razed and destroyed. Third, I advise that their prayer books and Talmudic... Believe it or not, I'm such a bad typist, I can't read my typing here. We'll skip that one. Fourth, I advise that their rabbis be forbidden to teach henceforth on the pain of loss of life and limb. Fifth, I advise that safe conduct on the highway be abolished completely for Jews. When you lay eyes on or think of a Jew, you must say to yourself, alas, that mouth which I there behold has prayed and pleaded before God that I, my wife and children, and all Christians might be stabbed to death and perish miserably. That's what he wrote.
But is that what the Jews were doing?
No. That's what he claims.
Why did he claim that?
Well, he writes this partly because he was part of a vast anti-Semitic worldview. And that's a very good question. Why did he write these things? I'm going to kind of steer us away from digging into the why right now and simply say that these are the literal words, the advice of Luther in relationship to the Jews. Now, it was some 400 years later that the German people did this in full force. Not the German people, the Nazis. So I'm simply holding up another contradiction. Here is someone who made these kinds of statements, and I'm suggesting we turn to him as a moral guide. Any thoughts on how to resolve that that problem?
Because everybody's human.
Okay. Everybody's human, and face the fact that those who have great moral wisdom also have great moral faults.
It's probably changed.
Times change. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That one's actually. Those are both very important, and the fact that we can now condemn. You know, we learn some things about Martin Luther King, and people will discredit him for those things. That's people are human. Well, I'd like to throw out to you. A couple of additional concepts, and I think those are two important ones. Times change, and everyone is human, and no one is perfect. I'd like to suggest to you my working resolution, and some of this I'll read to you, is that we draw upon our faith traditions in at least a couple of ways. That if we're going to draw upon tradition, including Scripture, that to do so faithfully is to do so critically. That faith must be critical. That we need to both draw upon constructively our ancestors and critique where they betrayed the gospel of Jesus Christ. And if we draw upon them, if we draw upon Scripture without being critical of it, then we're not being faithful. And certainly that's the model established by Jesus in drawing upon the Hebrew Scriptures. He drew upon the Hebrew Scriptures and he critiqued the Hebrew Scriptures, which was his Bible. And we are called to do the same with tradition. As I see it, there's a threefold theoethical, meaning a theological ethical task in drawing upon tradition. And remember, tradition, let's say in drawing upon tradition as a verb, in drawing upon the traditioning of our ancestors. There are many ways to articulate this kind of resolution. Mine is that we have three tasks. One is to uncover where the traditions have obscured or distorted the good news of God's creating, liberating, and sustaining love for all. Uncover that. In other words, what feminist scholars are doing with the Bible, uncover where the Bible has underwritten brutality against women. Take out those texts of terror and look at them, and look at what they've done to humanity. That is, uncover where Luther betrayed the gospel by condemning the Jews. And look at that and hold it up, apologize, name it. Secondly, seek out and hear the traditions where they have proclaimed the good news and embodied the love of Christ. I'll add a little piece to that. More and more I believe that in seeking out and hearing the traditions where they have faithfully proclaimed the good news, we need to look to the silenced voices in the traditions. We need to look to the domesticated voices. We need to look to the parts of the traditions that haven't been held up and heard. For instance, with Luther, we need to look to the pieces that we haven't heard well. His economic ethics, for instance. Have many of us read his radical, radical critique of emerging capitalism? That's a kind of silenced voice of Luther. We need to look to the women's voices throughout the tradition and hear the ways in which they were faithful. So our second task is really to dig in and hear the faithful voices and the faithful aspects of the voices. Our third task is to learn both from the betrayals and the faithfulness of our ancestors in order to forge paths of faithful practices today. So we take where they betrayed and we use that as a mirror. And we take where they were faithful and we learn from that. There are many ways to look at this paradox of how we draw upon people who did not only beautifully faithful things, but abominably horrible things. One tool that is given by Michael Lerner, Hebrew, Jewish scholar, and he says this about the Hebrew Testament. He says, it contains both the voice of God and the voices of human brokenness. And I think that's a useful way to look at it. Our traditions also, that they contain individual voices, contain the voice of God. Certainly Luther was revealing to us truths of God's love and the voices of human brokenness in many forms. So I will simply suggest that this is a model that can guide our digging into traditions, traditional figures for moral guidance. To take that and use it on Luther a little bit, the critical task, the first task, which I will call the critical task, it seems to me that in coming to know the dynamics, let's just use Luther as our case study, in coming to know the dynamics that caused his betrayals of God's love, we might get insight into the dynamics that cause our own betrayals, and that he and other traditional figures can be a kind of mirror in which we can see our own brokenness and our own tendencies to betray the love of God. I would suggest that a couple of dynamics shaped the ways in which, the times in which Luther really blew it in terms of the moral life. And one is, excuse me just a minute, around his the narrow parameters that he put around the concept of neighbor love. Neighbor love is enormously present in Luther's writing, in his main treatises. We're called to love neighbor in many ways, and they're very material ways, economically, many, many different ways. There are inconsistencies in who is the neighbor. Sometimes it's the people in my community, sometimes it's all of humankind in his language. But there are certain elements of humankind that are outside the boundary of neighbor in Luther's work. So that's an interesting little note. Some people don't... Neighbor is a kind of code word in Luther for the people to whom the people that we are to love. Outside of self and family, neighbor is all of the others to whom I am accountable with love. Some parts of humanity are outside the boundary of neighbor. And the Jews were outside the boundary of neighbor. They didn't qualify as neighbor, as recipient of neighbor love. So that says to me, we need to think about who is outside the boundary of neighbor. If we believe we are to love neighbor, and we live as we do in the global economy, who do we place outside the boundary of neighbor, or even outside the boundary of human? I remember when we were bombing Iraq in the Gulf War, and what was the name of the general in charge? Yeah. He spoke about the sound of the nations bombing together was like a chorus of angels. And he called it a bloodless victory. And the minute I heard bloodless victory, I thought about all of the dark-skinned people for whom it wasn't a bloodless victory. And I thought, those people are outside the boundary of the human. If that was a bloodless victory, and if we accepted it as a bloodless victory, then some people are not human. They're outside the boundary of the human. So, I guess I would say that in the critical task, we can learn from Luther in this way. We can learn that we need to notice who our society assumes to be outside the boundary of the human, and that's one of our keys. Are the children who make those soccer balls fully human? Are they neighbors, or are they outside the boundary of human? What qualifies as a neighbor? Now, today we note that much exploitation is of the earth. Do creatures and non-humans qualify as neighbors? What a moral question that is for us. Does love thy neighbor pertain to the forests that are being decimated? I think we need to hold up questions of who is neighbor in the world today. A second way in Luther in which the power for living toward and into neighbor love was undercut was that he passionately held medieval convictions regarding the ordering of society. We're not going to go into all of those now, but those convictions granted allegiance to the hierarchical structuring of society and a failure to question that. More than that, the ordering of society was coherent with the will of God. The way society was ordered was coherent with the will of God, and that worked against justice. For instance, slavery, slaves shouldn't seek freedom because they were, I wish I could give you the quote, but it would be against the will of God because the ordering of society has them lower. The ordering of society mandated, almost always in Luther, but not always, allegiance to government, and certainly not always. But this firmly held notion that the ordering of society as it was consistent with the will of God and was consistent with what was natural because of the will of God. So we can begin to think in what ways are our beliefs, our assumptions regarding the ordering of society, in what ways do we believe that they're just natural ever to be that way and consistent with the will of God? How do the fact that some people are placed in a hierarchy lower than others, how do we just see that as natural and kind of God-ordained in the way it will be? Can you think of examples of that in our lives that make us accept injustice, perhaps? That there's sort of an ordering that some people have more rights than other people. Do the children of Nicaragua have as much right to education and food and clothing as our children do? Do we somehow believe that the women on the streets of our cities who are homeless really have the same needs for aesthetic and intellectual fulfillment that all of us do? Or do we somehow see them as a little bit lesser and on a different level of human being or ordering of society?
Cindy, as you know, I've lived and worked in a number of parts of the world, a response that I have received over the last 20, 25 years of returning from places that people haven't heard of is a frequent question of why the heck would you want to go there?
Okay.
Which, to me, provides witness of this sense that we are human and you know, of family here, but out there is not. And the firsthand knowledge of somebody or someplace makes it human, brings it within the human realm, but lacking that, it's all theoretical and of secondary value.
Okay, that's a very, very good point. It's so terribly subtle. I mean, why would you want to go there? It sounds innocuous, but it does have subtle underpinnings of what you just said. Yes, Ron.
Example that we can see a change. That was the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of communism. I grew up knowing that there were two halves to the world, our side and their side. All of a sudden, it's not a half-half world anymore, but you know, theoretically independent states and we're friends with people who were our mortal enemies, and some of our good buddy pal friends we don't seem to need anymore because we're not fighting somebody else's good buddy pal friend. It's just to see a change practically overnight, as far as the official view, as far as the media view, as far as people's thinking, it's been fascinating.
That's a good point, and there are many examples of that. I mean, not many years ago, the ordering of society that we assumed to be God-ordained meant that men had rights and capabilities that women didn't have. And that has certainly significantly changed in our lifetimes. Yes?
Well, I just was going to say, one of the things I noticed pretty radically is we kind of celebrate the Americanization of all cultures. I mean, we think that's a good thing.
Oh, yes. Interesting. Yeah, that's a good example. So the ordering of the world assumed there is sort of that our way of life is better than. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
That's a very, very good example. And I think that we easily feel that. Oh, yes, that happens frequently, doesn't it? Yes.
At all levels, I think. Yeah.
And our language also betrays us when we talk about the third world.
Okay, good point.
And you just sort of blanket put all the developing countries in a different category.
A very good example that the developing countries are somehow not only secondary, but they're third. By our language, third world, which many people of those countries have refused and say we're not the third world. We're the two-thirds world, for example, is another way of saying it. There were two other comments. Yes?
Citizenship seems to be a huge
issue.
Oh,
interesting.
You look at illegal aliens in the United States, what services do they get?
Oh, yeah.
Their kids get to go to school, they get medical services. And then beyond that, you know, citizens of many different countries, it's a whole different order of standing.
That's another good point, that there's an ordering of humanity there, isn't there? Citizens have rights that non-citizens, and some of that, it's complex, isn't it? Because there are good arguments for aspects of that, and there are terrible arguments. The point also illustrates the complexity of this, of our assumptions of the ordering of society. Ron?
I think related to both of those assumptions, neighbor and order, come home around NIMBYism.
Now, what was that?
Around NIMBYism, in my backyard.
Oh, yes.
Who am I willing to accept as neighbor in my neighborhood?
Oh, that's a good point.
And both of them, I mean, rather than thinking globally, it's bringing it right home. Who am I willing to live next to?
Right, that's a very, very good example that I cannot accept as my neighbor. Well, gosh, there are many examples in our own neighborhood. A house for mentally ill people was being established, and the neighborhood was up in arms. And simply, these people were outside the boundaries of neighbor. Or let me just see if there are people who haven't commented yet. Yes.
I think to bring it back to the whole issue of globalization, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And economic, I think we have a whole different way of ordering our hierarchies. I don't mm-hmm. think anyone is really that concerned anymore about hierarchies of the way God created it in those. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a much more utilitarian mm-hmm. kind of hierarchy.
Very
in
good.
Terms of what kind of goods and service or mm-hmm. potential market is someone. And mm-hmm. the way exclusion works mm-hmm. is, if you have no resources, mm-hmm. if you have no market value, if there is no commodification mm-hmm. there, then you're mm-hmm. on the bottom of the hierarchy. And mm-hmm. the focus of that, in terms of who gets attention, who mm-hmm. doesn't get attention, is simply a utilitarian kind of hierarchical order, mm-hmm. rather than making any appeals to, mm-hmm. you know, by nature it's this way,
yes.
or God created
yes.
it this way. It's,
yes.
it's, if you will, very crassly, what's the cash benefit of this?
That is I think that's a truly relevant point in many ways. And one of the ways also is that is inherently a part of our belief system in a certain sense, that the value of a human being has to do with his or her monetary power. It pertains to the vote, you know, to electoral politics, where money influencing votes. It pertains to who are respected citizens in our communities and congregations. A very good point, kind of the commodification of the value of the human being. Does the penniless, homeless woman on the streets have the same inherent, or the same value in the standing of the community as the wealthy, wealthy businessman? That's a very good point. In the back.
A good example I've seen of the Americanization of the world, which really kind of disturbs and irritates me, is in my travels in Europe and Asia and stuff, mm-hmm. see McDonald's and Burger King and stuff, and even Starbucks. And mm-hmm. I haven't been there, but I know that mm-hmm. the McDonald's in, there's one in Moscow, and I remember it was like a week's wages mm-hmm. just for a meal there,
yeah.
and it just seems rather
grasp
that, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And again, that goes back to the notion that our way of life is the best. It goes back to the Bible study this morning. Michael pointed out two ways of eliminating people. One, killing them, and two, assimilating them. Assimilating into our way, which is higher on the pecking order of ways of being than the other. Rick, you had a comment.
Okay.
Well, that must have been a controversial comment. Well, listen, the point there, and these are good examples, the point is this. Neighbor love for Luther was severely undercut by beliefs that limited the parameters of neighbor, put a fence around neighbor, and naturalized the reigning social economic order. By that, I simply mean made it okay to have things structured as they were, to have the structures of privilege that were in place to be okay. And we need to look at the ways in which those two dynamics shape our acceptance of the reigning economic order today. And that is all to make the point that one of the things we need to do in drawing upon tradition is to look at where they made their mistakes and see how those mirror and illuminate for us the ways in which we also limit neighbor love. A second problem, and again we're talking about barriers to really turning to tradition, a second barrier to me, and it was named by somebody else here, I can't remember who already, it was Rick. How do we turn to people that didn't face what we faced? A man on the cusp of modernity, between the medieval world and the modern world, or whichever place you want to place him, certainly didn't face the destruction of the Earth's ecosystems. How do we turn to people for moral guidance when they simply didn't didn't have anything to do. It was off, our problems were off the screen for them. Nuclear warfare was off the screen for them. Overpopulation was certainly not of the globe was not their problem. How do we turn to them anyway for guidance in our moral life? Any thoughts or comments on that before I share mine? Well, by the way, I'm throwing these things out as questions to struggle with. So these are questions I'm struggling with. Part of my answer is this. I think a key is in what we seek. I think that in turning to forbearers, we don't need to seek moral rules. We don't need to seek their answer to how we should behave necessarily. In a couple of senses, we can't, I think we ask the wrong question of our ancestors. When we ask, how should we behave now, perhaps they can't answer. But what if we ask a different question? What if we ask the question of, when you were faithful, when you followed, and when it was hard, what enabled that? How did you know God in a way that enabled you to follow, to be faithful when it was hard? Mind you, to be faithful in the globalizing economy is hard. It's a strangely terrifying and difficult path. They walked strangely terrifying and difficult paths. Bonhoeffer, we can say, where did you find your power to follow that path? That's a different kind of question to ask of our forebearers. It was brought to me again in a different way in the Bible study this morning at the notion of truth. Too often we look, and this isn't what Michael said, it's just something that came through what he said. Too often we define truth, the truth that our forebearers offer, as propositional truth. This is true and this is false. What if we see truth in a different way, as the revelation of God's freedom and power? If we turn to them for the truth of how God is revealed and embodied by us and in us, that's a different question than saying, what moral truth do they offer to us, when sometimes they can't answer that question. Does that make any sense, or do you have any thoughts about the difference that that would make? It's a matter of, someone said up here at Holden, and I don't know who, that it seems like today we live on the fumes of Christianity. And when I heard that statement, I thought, and he, whoever said this was a man, I don't remember his name, but he was talking about certain communities in the past that didn't just live on the fumes of Christianity. And I thought, there are keys to how they lived, and it's a different question to ask them, how they drank the dew of God's Spirit. Maybe we can't ask Irenaeus what to do about economic globalization. We can ask Irenaeus how he came to drink the dew of God's Spirit, how he came to know himself as a piece of clay being molded. And mark you, this knowing of God, well, this was pre-original sin. I mean, Irenaeus is pre-Augustine. So he didn't believe in original sin. And he did believe that by accepting, remaining moist, that's his word, to the molding hands of God, we would be crafted. And we would be crafted progressively and slowly into beings who bore God within and were in union and communion, those are his words, with God. Jesus Christ came not for the purpose of dying on the cross to save us for our sins. Jesus Christ saved us by becoming incarnate, by becoming body, to accustom God to dwelling in human form, and to accustom human beings to union with God. Now, he's not an idealist or a sugar-coated guy. He knows that we make grand mistakes, unfaithful mistakes, but that if we remain receptive, the mistakes shape us toward union and communion. Not just towards gratitude, not just towards intellectual knowledge, but towards a union with God. So I'm giving that as an example of if we ask him something about where the power for faithfulness came, we learn that it had to do with the things I just said. We can't ask him, how to deal with economic globalization. We can ask him how to drink something more than the fumes of Christianity. So I'm just making that as a kind of methodological clue as how we tap in toward how we tap into the power of our heritage by simply asking a different question than the question that ethical inquiry or seeking moral guidance from the past often asks. I think there are a couple of other clues to digging into our using our ancestors, and we don't have time to go into all of them. One of them that I would just raise now, and I want to end on time this time, another of them is who we put them in dialogue with. And I'll give again Luther as a case study. I've been turning to Luther in my writing and research as a guide around economic justice issues. And one of the things that has seemed important to me is to put Luther in conversation with certain people. He bears a lot of insight and wisdom, but not alone. He needs to be in conversation with people who really have a good sense of what's going on in the globalizing economy. So if I take Luther's words and I hold them up and listen also to contemporary ecofeminists, for example, who are saying that the earth is God's body, that the earth is being crucified by human activity today. If I hold Luther up in dialogue with Vandana Shiva, a third world person who knows clearly and analyzes clearly the impacts of globalization on her people, what do we get if we hold our ancestors in dialogue with, in conversation with contemporaries who can give a clearer analysis of our situation? There, I think, is another key to letting our ancestors guide us today. Questions or concerns, thoughts about that? Offense taken?
I'll probably drop that to my part of our native belief, and also in the sense of Christianity part, is that what we do and our actions that we do, we are looking 7 generations ahead of us.
Uh-huh.
Because it ends up what actions we do at our time and our mm-hmm. place on earth mm-hmm. right now, mm-hmm. our actions are going to affect 7 generations ahead of us. One of the things that we also, partly what you were just mentioning now, was that we look at our ancestors and see what they have done to help protect the Mother mm-hmm. Earth.
Okay.
And we look ahead.
And that's a very pertinent point in two ways. One, you'll notice here in my last question, or on the flip to the other page, it says sustain communities for generations to come. I get that from the indigenous tradition, that we look towards generations to come. Also, we have to note, and I take this from your comment, that we are the first, modern humanity is the first people on the face of the earth that has not turned to its ancestors for moral wisdom. We're the first set of human beings that have somehow decided that they didn't know enough to teach us. So in a sense, it's a request that I make to for us to dissociate from that piece of modernity.
Part of that would be from many of our people of the United States are people from another country, except for our First Nations people.
True, which makes our ancestors less accessible. Let me very quickly say where we're going and why I did this session. Where we're going is tomorrow to really dig into what Luther can teach us in a number of ways in terms of guidance towards economic justice today. And then on the last day, the following day, whatever that is, Saturday, we're going to talk about what Luther can teach us about moral power grounded in Jesus Christ living in us, living in our bodies as community, as people in community. So those are two things for which we're going to turn to Luther. Economic justice questions and moral power questions grounded in the indwelling Christ. I simply did not want to, one of my principles as an ethicist is don't draw upon traditional figures of tradition without first doing critique. And so I wanted to lay out some tools, some principles, some ideas about how we can both draw from and critique in one breath our ancestors. Because to me, there's no integrity in not adding that critique to the drawing upon. So that's where we will go. And my intent is to simply push the notion of drawing deeply from the wellsprings of faith that are our traditions to find the power today to live faithfully in the face of incredible injustice that's wrapped up into every day of our lives. Thank you. And we made it in time.